Welcome, everyone. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters, and there's a lot of paradigm shifting going on all over the world where we're learning as human beings to have consciousness far beyond what we expect. And one of the things they're doing in the, I guess they call it the intersection between technology and the medical world and psychology, is a lot of brain scanning to show us what kind of potential does exist in our brain. Potential for recognizing patterning, potential for releasing the patterning, and who knows where it all goes to when you're shifting paradigms. So I'm very excited tonight to present a guest. Now, I'm probably going to mess up your last name. This is a naturopathic doctor who actually scanned my brain for me yesterday and gave me some pictures of what my brain looks like. Well, so welcome to Paradigm Shifters, Dr. Saeed Mushtaq. Is that right?
Perfect. You got it right. Thanks.
Oh, I did it right. Wow, good for me. I must have good memory after all, right? I'm really excited to talk to you and share with people what's going on with this kind of what's called brain mapping, brain scanning. Mm-hmm. I've been fascinated for years, but it's still in a state of blooming, isn't it? Bringing forward an awful lot more information. So tell us, first of all, who you are and how did you get into this part of working with people?
Yeah, for sure. I'm super excited to actually be on your show and talk about the brain mapping and the QEG brain mapping too. So a little bit about me. I'm a naturopathic doctor. I got into the naturopathic field mainly out of my own curiosity and journey in terms of dealing with some of the mental health issues that I had growing up, the attention problems and the history of head injuries that I had. I got into naturopathic medicine as a way of figuring out different ways of treating that naturally.
I want to interrupt you here and tell people that you've got a TED Talk up that they might find very enjoyable about ADD or your own experience.
Yeah, thanks. I've been doing practicing naturopathic medicine since 2006. And in the last 4 years, I became more interested in the mind and the brain health component of the mental health, specifically as a way of, specifically QEG as a way of seeing into the function of the brain. So I went and got some training and got the equipment that's required for running quantitative EEG. And QEG is basically quantitative electroencephalograms. It's a way of recording the electrical activities of the brain. And
is that an enhancement of what we used to call the EEG?
EEG is, the technology is improved. It hasn't changed much. It's still the same thing. The Q there is indicating that you're taking an individual's EEG and running a quantitative study by comparing it to a database of other individuals within the same age group. So you're quantifying the data that you get from an individual. Because on an EEG, there are certain things that you can see on an EEG. Like it's the number one diagnostic for seizures. Seizure patterns show up on EEG readily.
So what they're showing is kind of how the frequencies, the energies of our brain move and where they get blocked. Is that what it's showing?
That's exactly what it's showing. It's showing, the brain, there's three rhythms that are constant in the body. There's your breath. You have some conscious control of that. There's your heart. You have some conscious control over that. And there's your brain electrical activity. These are three constants. So whether at rest or when you're thinking, whether you're doing any activity, whether you're asleep, your brain is constantly making these electrical waves, and it's making them over a certain range of frequencies. Those frequencies start from 0 hertz all the way up to 70 and 80 hertz of frequency, which is and the higher the frequencies, the more, the quicker oscillating waves are being produced.
Does that mean we're smarter then, or does it have any bearing on that?
There are ways of using QEGs to assess the IQ, mm-hmm. And activity of the brain. The higher frequencies, the gamma wave frequencies, show up when the brain is acting coherently, when different regions of the brain are communicating and they're locked in, talking to each other. So, yeah, gamma comes up in higher order of thinking patterns.
So is gamma more transcendent? Is that what you're saying?
It is. Gamma is more, in a way, is more transcendent because it's reflective of a brain that is working coherently.
Hmm.
It's also the toughest brainwave to record.
Oh.
As pretty much any type of electrical equipment, whether it's your cell phone, whether it's your computer, whether it's even the devices that actually are used to record it, oven themselves are producing gamma. All electrical devices make gamma. So it becomes a difficult brainwave to actually record without too much noise from external sources.
Oh, I see. So it gets mixed up in what normally goes out there anyway, huh?
Exactly.
Hmm. Yeah. So tell us the breakdown of the other ones. It's gamma, then it's beta?
So coming down from the high frequencies, you got gamma, you got beta, there is alpha, there is theta, and there is delta. And the way to make sense of them is gamma is, in a way, is an emergent property of the brain, meaning that when the brain is coordinating, where it's doing complex tasks, you get an emergence of gamma. Then the beta is a brain that's doing conscious activity. So when you're solving a math problem, when you're paying attention, certain ranges of the beta are called SMR beta brain waves, which are when athletes feel in the zone. That's where the brain is making. And then when you come down, it's alpha. Alpha is if I was to put a number on them. Anything above 20 hertz would be considered gamma. Between 12 and 20 is considered beta, and then 9 to 12 is alpha. And alpha is is what you want to get into when you're meditating, for example. Like that is paying attention. It's the brain that's present, taking in information, but idling, not doing much about it. To show an example is as soon as you close your eyes, the level of alpha starts increasing in the brain. Because what happens is that you put the visual cortex and its connection with the rest of the brain into a resting state. So alpha comes up. But alpha is also what you try to achieve and be in, which is a meditative state in general. Meditation increases alpha.
But you're saying beta is when you're thinking your brain's out, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. But beta is when you're presented a problem that you're squeezing the peanut in a way. But the more you work your brain out, the higher betas you get into,
okay,
which can trigger anxiety and worry.
Oh, okay.
So beta is, all these waves are important, but they're important when they are present in actual desired amounts, not too much or too little. And that's what the quantitative EEG comes in, is a way of sensing if the brain is making too much or too little of one versus the other at rest.
Mm-hmm. And so that could create psychological and physical problems, right?
Yeah, it's a reflection in a way. It's a reflection of psychological problems or physical problems. For example, elevated beta not only shows up in anxiety, it also shows up in chronic pain.
Really? Okay.
From migraines, recurrent pains, tend to have elevated beta as well. So alpha, which was the 9 to 12 range, is considered almost, you know, the frequency range between the subconscious and the conscious. So the beta being the conscious, alpha being present, meditative mind, and then the delta and the theta, the lower, slower waves being the subconscious brain. So you go down from alpha, you get to theta, which is the frequencies. These are waves that are oscillating between 4 hertz, 4 cycles a second, to about 8 cycles a second. And these are waves that are made during creative aspects of thinking, creative modes. They're also when the brain is just shifting and daydreaming between different thoughts and different memories and scenarios. When you do hypnosis, the idea is to actually put the brain in a theta state so that it's more suggestible. And it takes in an outside information and integrates it.
Do you say put the brain into theta state? Is there a way to do that? Of course, that's I guess farther down in our discussion, but that's interesting.
Yeah, there is multiple ways to do that. The good news is there's multiple ways to actually influence and shift these brain waves. A lot of them take practice. Like one of the easiest ways, practice and time dedication. Really, it's time dedication. It's listening to a binaural beat is one of the easiest ways to actually influence the different brain waves.
That's where you have different beats coming in either ear, both ears having slightly different. Is that right?
Slightly different, yeah. So like, let's say if you're putting in a 2 hertz from one ear and a 4 hertz, the difference between the two will create a 2 hertz cycle. Okay. And that 2 hertz binaural is the closest to the theta range. So it's going to pull down all the brain waves to the lowest frequency, which is going to create the calmest, most relaxed state. Because delta, which is the lowest, is what you produce during REM sleep, during really deep sleep. So there's different ways of influencing these brain waves, for sure.
Let me ask you something for fun. You know the little temple bells? I'm sure you've seen them, and they're connected usually with a piece of thong of leather, and they're just little metal bells, and you bang them together, and they have a resonance slightly. There's a space between the frequencies when you hear them. Do you know what I mean? That's for?
That's exactly like so, and even like the bowls that you hold in your hand, and you you run I don't know what the name is, but you run this little wooden instrument around to actually create that woo sound.
Right.
That is like, you know, it's just that beat is a delta beat. It's a very slow resonance.
And that's to take your brain down into what would you say, into the transcendence is gamma, but this is way lower and without, what would you say, without influence?
Subconscious state to an open, accessible brain, a brain that's more more open to its environment with the lowest frequencies.
Oh, wow. So it's open to have new concepts, new ideas, new freedoms, new evolution. Is that right?
Yeah. And detached also. There's a level of detachment with the lower frequencies, with the delta and theta. In some ways, it's a good thing. As adults that are constantly engaged in problem solving, making decisions, as an average person, we are making 1,000 times more decisions per day than our ancestors did 1,000 years ago. So we are constantly engaged in a beta. So using these tools to bring us to the lower frequencies is a way of shifting and taking away our attachment to this constant need for achievement and doing. So it's a brain that's detached, but in contrast, like in an individual that's got learning disabilities, what you would see on a QEEG, you would see elevation of these slow waves. You would see naturally, like in their brain, you would see high thetas and high deltas, which shows that this individual has got a difficulty to take in information and incorporate it, which translates to learning disability.
Aha. So that could be difficult unless you're off to try to meditate yourself into a new space, right?
Exactly.
Huh. So I want to jump back to the beta. Let me see. What did you say? You said elevated beta or beta elevated it often links to chronic pain. Is that why, and this is a sidebar, but I think it's interesting, for at least for me, but there's so many people on SSRIs or SSRIs, whatever they're called, antidepressants. And I heard recently somebody was saying, well, that's because they have a lot to do with chronic pain. Is that where the link is in those?
Yeah. SSRIs are typically they have different impacts on individuals. There are some increased beta, actually.
Okay.
If depression is generally it's got a few patterns of presentation on QEEG. The most common presentation is a disharmony or an asymmetry of presentation where the right brain is making less alpha, and then the left brain is making more alpha. SSRIs can influence the amount of beta that you're making so that it compensates for an overactive alpha on one side of the brain. All the medications, pretty much every medication influences brain waves as a general rule. Whether it's an SSRI, so even some of the medications that are used for improving, let's say, high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the high blood pressure medications are in fact working by influencing brain waves.
Well, all of this is really interesting. I want to ask so many different directions. One of the most obvious directions to go in is, can you talk a little bit about how people would use this to heal them? What kind of people come for brain, brain mapping? What do they come for? Do they come to get fixed? Do they come for chronic pain? Do they come for evolution? Do they come for children, whatever?
Yeah, I guess if I give you a little bit of a history about where QEEG comes from, that would make things a little bit more clear for your listeners. In terms of the history and usage, it goes back to the 1970s in NASA. They were doing some experiments with an anti-seizure drug that was given to the cats. It was a seizure-inducing drug. They were giving them to these cats to see if the, which cats will have a higher tolerance or a lower tolerance. What happened was that there was one group of these cats that had come in from a different experience, and in that experience, these cats were attached to a QEEG or an EEG device. It was a single electrode that was on their heads. And the cats were in a little cage, and within outside the cage there was a tube, a see-through glass tube, where a mouse could run back and forth. And these cats, so hyper, intensely excited in what the mouse is going to do, they were sitting there in front of the tube in their cage, not moving at all, paying constant attention to what the mouse is going to do. What they were trying to see is the brain of the cat when it's paying attention, is it making a specific type of frequency or not? And what they figured out is that frequency range was roughly between 11, 10 and 12 hertz frequency, which is considered the SMR frequency, which is what athletes talk about being in the zone. So these cats were basically got into the state where their brain was making SMR brain waves for extended periods of time. And that's all that was that came out of that experiment. They were packed up, shipped to another experiment where these experimenters were giving them seizure medications. And lo and behold, the cats that came from that first experiment were able to tolerate higher dosages of the seizure-inducing medication than the other cats that hadn't been producing SMR brainwaves.
Hmm.
What they realized was that a brain that practices making SMR brainwaves can tolerate chemical intoxication better. That was the very beginning part of, okay, well, you know, yes, we know the brain is making different brainwaves, but what are the influences of these brainwaves and how they how we can manipulate them?
Hmm.
So those were the early studies in the 70s. Based on that, there were other studies done specifically with individuals that had attention disorders.
Okay.
Those are the very first experiments that we get in the world of neurofeedback. It's individuals having attention disorders or having been diagnosed with attention disorders, and experimenting with neurofeedback in the sense that creating the right environment for their brain to specifically make these SMR activities to see if there is an outcome. And from there, there was then studies done with concussion individuals after concussion. The Department of Defense in the U.S. started experimenting with war veterans with PTSD to see if the EEG brain training can influence them. And
did it?
Oh, yeah. So in the order of the things that that neurotraining or neurofeedback training it can influence is, number one is any type of attention disorder.
Okay.
In fact, compared to the amphetamines, which are listed as a primary treatment for ADD and ADHD.
I mean, like Ritalin and so on. Eh?
Ritalin and so on, yeah. Mm-hmm. Ritalin, Concerta, and the rest of them, neurofeedback is a primary form of treatment for attention disorders.
Hmm.
Except that it's being used as readily because it's so much easier to prescribe than to have someone do a neurofeedback session, 20, 30 neurofeedback sessions, in order to teach themselves how to regulate this.
Do you ever see a way that neurofeedback sessions can be reduced to, say, 2 or 3 sessions?
No.
For the same outcome, I mean, you know.
No, it can't, because it's gym for the brain, right?
Oh,
it's
okay.
That would be like saying that, you know, can I go to the gym twice and be fit? You definitely need the repetition. It's literally gym for the brain. It's identifying a network, a region of the brain that's underactive or overactive,
mm-hmm.
and then practicing to influence that region in specific.
So you think that the clients, or you're saying that the clients or the patients can influence their own brain if they see the rate at which it's working, is that right?
Absolutely, because a brain is a reflective organ. They did this experiment with college students. It's called a priming experiment. They had two groups of college students standardized for their age, their background, socioeconomic status. And the experiment was that they would read a string of 4 letters. So let's say a string of four letters with a fifth, a string of four words with a fifth word that was that didn't make sense within the context of those other four.
Okay.
So let's say.
Which one doesn't belong?
Yeah, which one doesn't belong? So, like, let's say California is sunny today and patience.
Okay, okay? I see, yes.
If you presented these five words in random string, so, like, sunny, patience, today, California is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then and then you were asked to make a sentence and identify the word that doesn't fit. So each experimenter was given, like, 10, 15 of these five words, and the group A, the floater words were patience, slow, gracious, courteous, wait, and whatnot. These were the floater words. In the second group, the floater words were right now, fast, go, immediately, and so on.
Okay.
So the experiment was so that these students would read these 10 or 15 sentences, and then they would have to go down the hall, take the stairs up, go to an office in which a professor was engaged in conversing with another student, and their students, the experimenter's task was to deliver a note to that professor. So what happened was that they discovered that the individual groups with floater words that involved patience, slow, courteous, and whatnot, invariably they waited much longer to interrupt the conversation of the professor and present them with the letter. Whereas the ones that, you know, that the floater letter was, you know, do it now or immediately and whatnot, they interrupted the conversation the prof was having to give them the letter. So, I mean, that definitely shows, that's an experiment, it's a primary experiment that shows that the brain is a reflective organ. It reflects what is presented to you. Whether that which is presented is words, whether it's an environment, whether it's that you go for a walk in nature and you feel calmer, or you watch a movie that's stressful and you have, like, you know, an emotional reaction to, your brain is reflecting what is coming in. In that sense, when it comes to neurotraining or neurofeedback, what is done is that we present the brain with what it is doing. We just show what it's doing, and we allow it to reflect on what it's doing. So if the brain is, producing a lot of beta waves, we show that through the computer program in a way that it can understand that it's producing too much beta waves.
Okay.
And if it's making too little, we show that to a computer program so that the brain that sees itself is a brain that starts changing itself. So there's practice required with neurofeedback in the sense, it is an exercise. It is evolved and changed quite a bit. It used to be that if you wanted to treat someone with ADD, they needed about 40 to 50 sessions.
Oh, wow.
But it's come down to 15 to 20 sessions now, because the equipment has become more complex. We now use multiple electrodes on the head as opposed to single or double electrodes. And there's a limit to that. But when you look at the studies that are done with attention disorders, there is a faster, quicker response with something called Loretta neurofeedback, which uses the entire brain to teach, as opposed to traditional single point or double point neurofeedback.
Oh, I see.
Because, you know, let's say when it comes to attention, there's roughly about four different attention networks, and let's say the ventral attention network, which is the attention network that allows you to follow speech and conversation and be in the moment and a string of words. Let's say in an individual, the ventral attention network, which can have as high as 14 different nodes, is hyperactive.
Okay.
It's not hyperactive in all its nodes. It's hyperactive in 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 nodes. But the other 10 nodes are doing their work properly. So if you're training this brain, those other 10 nodes can compensate for the underactivity of the 3 or 4 nodes that are not functioning properly.
Hmm.
So you can train the entire network, or you can just train the nodes that are not working. If you train the entire network, you're going to get a faster response. So neurofeedback is moved from just specifically affecting the frequencies of the brain and a small range of frequencies to now affecting those frequencies over networks and their connectivity. So
it makes me feel like it's like a community, and when all the community pitches in, things work better.
You got it. That's exactly what it is. It's a community, and sometimes, you know, different individuals in the community pick up the slack for the rest of them.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that interesting, eh?
Mm-hmm.
As above, so below. Oh, and I have one other little conjecture I'm making you know how many years ago, and I know you're young and all, but when they broke the 4-minute mile, you know, I've often thought about that because I think I was at that. I was a small kid and, you know, in racing and running. But after that, many, many people could break it. And I always thought we kind of pass on our potential, don't we? We pass on our human potential in sometimes rather subtle ways, do we not?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in the same way, we pick up the negative patterns that we are surrounded by, and those become limitations for us.
That's like the reflections of all the violent movies and so on, eh? And the games. Like, I worry about that.
Yeah, it's like even something to, like, you know, to some extent, when we talk about attention disorders, ADD and ADHD, some of that is also learned.
Mm.
You know, some of those experiences is, you know, when the child has never had the opportunity to actually have to sit down and self-regulate. It used to be that, you know, as a community, we had group gatherings and certain structures and roles around ceremonies and whatnot, which nowadays kids don't get much of it until they get into school. So there's a lot of free-flowing parenting, and there's not as much rigidity and rules around, okay, sit down and just do this small task. Or even, like, you know, playing with toys. Like, the kid is overwhelmed with tons of toys and it jumps from one thing to the next, whereas, you know, it used to be that you had one or two toys and you played all sorts of games with that one truck that you had.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got like 20 trucks and you get tired of one, you jump to the other one. So again, it's like the brain is learning these limitations. Same thing that goes with like post-traumatic stress. Like, you know, it's emotional stress that you experience becomes integrated into the brain, and that becomes the norm for the brain, and it doesn't know a different way around it. So it ends up suffering because it picked up and it's reflecting that history of emotional suffering now.
Mm-hmm.
And in that,
if the shock is too deep for you to think it through at that point, is that right?
Yeah.
But you can train people out of that, hey?
Yeah, it's so neurofeedback is actually, there's recent studies that are coming out with post-traumatic stress,
mm-hmm.
With schizophrenia and with bipolar disorder. And it's showing improvements. It's not showing as much improvement that's, you know, we like to see, and we do see in cases of attention disorder and concussion, and in cases of, say, anxiety. But still, when you identify those regions of the brain, you can actually reduce the patient's need for medication. You can increase their ease in life, And you can reduce the frequency of unwanted emotional states. Because a great deal of post-traumatic stress is an inability of the attention network to allow the person to be present. As the attention starts shifting to unwanted thoughts, it's the attention network's job to actually bring the thoughts back into the present. So when you train the attention network, it becomes more fit, and that fitness starts showing in all levels of the person's experience.
Wow, and that takes quite a few sessions, though, huh?
It does. Typically, a quantitative EEG is a statistical analysis of the brain. So it's statistically, you place the brain and we compare it to other individuals. The example I like to use is, if you were to measure everybody's height, some people are going to be super short, some people are going to be super tall, but the average person is going to be within the belly of that bell curve.
Mm-hmm.
So in a quantitative EEG, we look at the brain waves ranging from the delta, theta, alpha, beta, and gamma, and we ask the question of, okay, where are these really short or really tall brain waves? Where are these abnormalities? And then we identify those, select them, and we try to train the individual to move them towards the norm. And over a span of, let's say, anywhere from 14 to 20 sessions, individuals are capable of shifting their brain waves by one standard deviation. Now, that's a huge difference.
Okay.
Because, let's say one standard deviation is the difference between, in medical terms, having osteoporosis and mm-hmm. having good bone density.
Oh,
right?
I see. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Deviation is the difference between having a learning disability and being a slow learner.
Well, let me do a big jump here and say, okay, can you use it in order to increase your bone density, you know what I mean, jumping from the comparison you made with osteoporosis or...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, can it be used that way? Can we use reflective brain activity in order to teach our bodies to shift how it handles physical problems?
I would say no.
Okay.
There is some merit to doing visualization and
mm-hmm.
using the brain's power in order to achieve certain things. So if you were to visualize your osteoblasts and osteoclasts, these are the cells in the bones going in and remodeling your bones and increasing their density, over time you could achieve things with that.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't necessarily think of neurofeedback as a way of changing bone density. There's a lot of other things that would be useful, like pulse EMF is the number one treatment of choice for treating osteoporosis.
So what's pulse EMF? Let's see what that is.
Pulse EMF is subjecting the body into pulses of electromagnetic waves at very, very low densities. So let's say in microtesla levels. So if you go and get an MRI, you're going to be taking in a magnitude of 1 to 10 tesla of a field, electromagnetic field, which is measured in tesla units. But using very, very minute amounts of that in microtesla and giving a pulse and then no pulse, pulse, no pulse. So alternating pulse with no pulse increases blood flow and increases bone density.
Hmm. Oh, that's
and
good to know, isn't it?
Yeah. And on the brain, it's got an additional effect that it increases neuroplasticity of the brain for a period of 20 to 30 minutes after a pulse EMF treatment. So pulse EMF is actually, PEMF is, the treatment is called transcranial PEMF. So transcranial PEMF is used as a way of influencing brain waves also.
Well, so if you increase neuroplasticity for 30 minutes or whatever, what could I do with that, Saeed? right then.
Yeah, so let's say we increase your neuroplasticity and then we get you to practice math questions.
Mm-hmm.
So you basically you've increased your ability to learn and problem solve for 30 minutes and you've given it problems. So the outcome is going to be more pronounced than if your neuroplasticity wasn't there. You know how they say you can't teach an old dog?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you increase neuroplasticity, you can teach the old dog new tricks.
Well, as an old dog, I'm excited about that. it's very fascinating to me because there's so many evolutionary things here. I just want to throw another thing in is if the brain is a reflective tool, a reflain is, I shouldn't call it a tool, but, you know, a reflective part of our being.
Yeah.
There's somebody I remember reading that was talking about having the brain pulses of maybe it was the Dalai Lama or a great saint or something that they had people working with. Do you ever use, you know, for neurofeedback, someone else's brain potential, someone else's brain scan in order for people to get up to speed or, you know, you understand what I'm saying?
Maybe you reframe that question.
Okay, so when you're doing a brain scan or a mapping of someone, say of me or someone else, and I had my own anxieties in it and so on, and you said that would affect me or whoever's brain scan it is by being able to see where the anxieties are. You said there's a reflective interaction there that can help.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm saying, well, what if the person's brain scan in front of them was not their own, but someone of a more exalted, calm level or something? Is that A, ever done, and B, could that have a huge impact on your client, your patient?
Yeah. So, going back to the origin of neurofeedback, there was a doctor, Barry Sternman, that was doing the experiments with these cats and basically identified the SMR and started experimenting with it. What they find out is if you do sham neurofeedback, meaning that you start reflecting, you start giving feedback to the person, a visual feedback or a sounding feedback. If that feedback is the direct reflection of their own brain, it works. But if it's random or if it's from someone else's brain activity that's changing, that's influencing the feedback doesn't work.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's neurofeedback is classical conditioning.
Okay.
In classical conditioning, you have three things that happens. You have a stimuli, a secondary stimuli, and then you have a response. So in the classical conditioning of dogs with food, so going back to
Pavlov's
experiment. Mm-hmm. He put in food, the stimuli, in front of the dogs while ringing a second stimuli, which is the bell, and he got the response of salivation from the dogs. And then after a while, connecting these three things, he took away the food and just rang the bell. So the dogs became conditioned to salivate by ringing of the bell.
Hmm.
Now, in neurofeedback, we do the exact same thing. What we do is we run a QEG or a quantitative EEG. We identify the networks that are underactive or overactive, and we write a program based on that. And that program interfaces with the brainwave activities that's being recorded and starts modulating a video that you're watching. So every time those regions that are underactive move a little bit closer to the norm, or the areas that are overactive move a little bit closer and lower to the norm, the feedback is the video goes full screen.
Oh, that's interesting, huh?
Yeah, and every time those regions are not functioning properly, the video shrinks into a dot.
Oh, wonderful.
Feedback saying you did the right thing when it does the right thing, or you didn't do the right thing when it doesn't do the right thing. Now,
that's really a magical tool, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's super cool. And the beauty of it is this. The person sitting in the front of the video is not doing much. All they are doing is they are inhaling on the count of 1 to 4, exhaling on the count of 1 to 6. So they're doing this breath called the heart rate variability breath, which is one of the most relaxing breaths that you can take. So in a way, they are ringing the bell, which is their breath, and connecting that stimuli with the right brainwave activity. Then they go home and sit down every morning and every night and just practice that breath. They ring the bell in order to get the secondary stimuli, which is salivation or the right brainwave activity. So in a way, we give individuals a tool, which is that breath, to regulate their brainwave activity.
So if I ring my bell every time I finish the 7 minutes, then later I would be able to ring the bell and just get the effect. Is that right?
Well, I'm using the ringing the bell as an analogy. The breathing is the ringing of the bell.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In neurofeedback, you're doing a regular heart rate variability breathing while watching the feedback on the screen that's being modulated by the QEEG, the brainwaves. So in a way, The primary stimuli is, which in the Pavlov experiment was food, is the visual feed that you get on the screen from the movie modulating.
Mm-hmm.
The secondary stimuli, which in Pavlov's experiment was ringing of the bell, is the cyclical breaths that you're doing. And the desired function, which is in Pavlov's experiment was salivation, here becomes the right brainwave activity.
I love this. You know what? Wouldn't it be absolutely wonderful if little kids in preschool and so on were taught to work with that, to play with that?
It would be wonderful. I mean, a lot of sports teams are actually taking advantage of this.
I can see why. My gosh, we get to human potential here.
Yeah, like a lot of NHL teams have incorporated the mind technology equipment from Montreal, University of Montreal, as a way of neurotraining. The Spanish soccer team that won 2 World Cups back to back was doing neurofeedback as a way of learning how to put themselves into the zone so that they're not distracted by other thoughts and they're focused on their game and they're in the zone and they're playing. If you actually search for neurofeedback clinics or neurofeedback centers, you find that some of them are specifically catering not necessarily towards patients, but more to executives as a way of helping them find their zone of being more productive.
I really can understand that. That is, it's actually really exciting. And are you excited about it? Are you always learning new levels of it?
I'm super excited about this. For me, I'm still learning about it. I'm still in the process of, I have a mentor that I work with some of my cases. We go back and forth, and it's an ocean. I'm still learning. I'm still learning about this. And the most fascinating thing for me is that, you know, some of these medical conditions that we have come to label as things that need drugs to be changed are really brain postures that can be changed with practice and with exercise.
What a good way to put it.
Yeah. So that's the fascinating part to me. That's the fascinating part is moving away from the chemical understanding of the brain problems into more like an energetic postural thing that the brain is going through that can be adjusted, shifted, and maintained with proper exercise.
I think it's so exciting. I really, I'm very impressed. So you're including the pulse EMF in your biofeedback work, right?
Yeah. So we use the pulse EMF as a warm up with all the neurofeedback that we do in the clinic. We use the pulse EMF also. It's very useful in individuals with stroke and concussion.
Okay.
More so than the ADD and ADHD, pulse EMF, not only because it increases the neuroplasticity, but also it reduces inflammation. So post-concussion, there's a lot of inflammation that goes on in the brain that can become chronic, because the brain is really good at protecting itself by having a skull around it, mm-hmm. but it's very good at resolving an inflammation after it happens. When that barrier is taken away and an impact creates that inflammation, localized inflammation, the brain is not very good at healing it.
Mm. But you're finding that you had a lot of healing for concussions in this work, right?
A lot of healing for concussion, the majority of my patients are individuals post-concussion and because post-concussion, you actually get pretty much everything related to mental health could go wrong. If the concussion happened over the anxiety network, the person can develop anxiety. If the concussion influenced the mood network, the person develops depression. If it happened over the attention network, the person develops ADD. Hmm. So concussion can mimic a lot of mental disorders, and there is a more and more understanding that a lot of these things are actually post-concussive disorders rather than a frank ADD or a frank ADHD or a frank depression. It's just a post-concussive encephalopathy. It's a brain that's in a constant inflammation state that is triggering the mood changes.
Well, and also, that's fascinating, actually, you mentioned schizophrenia a while back. Have you heard any, is it similar? It not necessarily coming from concussions, but can you introduce a shift in how the brain works to a schizophrenic person or a bipolar person?
Yeah, based on the studies that are out there, it creates enough of a shift so that these patients, the study comes out of a group of inpatient schizophrenics. So patients that were in the hospital that needed to be hospitalized, they couldn't be released. And what happened was that post-neurofeedback, majority of them were able to be released from the hospital and become independent. Not independent of medication, they still needed to take their medication to self-regulate, but their disease was more regulated and controlled.
Mm-hmm. You said host, what did you call it, host feedback?
No, neurofeedback.
Okay, all right. Well, this is all, it's really cutting edge too. You don't even know all you can do yet, do you?
I said post-neurofeedback, after neurofeedback.
Oh, I thought you said host. I was thinking back. Well, never mind about that. But it's a pretty interesting thing. I do a lot of energy work. A lot of us do. And I keep thinking the brain, the way you're talking about it, is all just energy systems in a way, isn't it? You know?
It is energy system. It is the organ that allows, our higher susceptibilities of spirit to be able to manifest itself. It's our window between the physical world and the spiritual world, between the physical reality and the energetic reality. It's the organ that allows for that connection to happen. We certainly don't know a lot about it. We know some about it, and our understanding of it is increasing and growing.
Oh, yes. It's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm super impressed, and our time is up, but maybe you'll come back and speak on another aspect of this at some point fairly soon. That'd be great.
Yeah, I would love to. I would love to. It's been a game changer in my practice.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a game changer in the practice of psychology as a whole in the long run, because it's a tool that gives us like a keyhole into visualizing what's happening within the brain. So in psychology and psychiatry as a whole, it's one branch of medicine that really has no tool for looking into the organ they're treating. And the tools they have, such as functional MRI or PET scans and whatnot, are so cumbersome and expensive that individual practitioners can't use. Whereas QEEG, it has the same kind of sensitivity and reliability as a functional MRI when it comes to the function of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it can pick up the organic structural changes, but it's going to be a tool that's going to be more integrated, and it's a vast area of research and understanding. And I would be happy to talk more about specifics of it.
I would love that, because I told you, or you and I were talking, we had a wonderful talk the other day, and
yeah.
We were talking about how Joe Dispenza has been doing brain scans at the beginning of his 5-day workshops and then at the end of them and showing how the brain is actually changed. And that's a pretty high intensity thing, but at least there's some studies there, hey?
Yeah, and that's like one of the things that we do in the clinic is with patients, some of the patients that have high theta presence,
mm-hmm.
It could be a depression picture, it could be a learning disability picture, but it responds really well to binaurals, like I said. So what we do is we do the recording while playing different music to them, and they're listening to the music, and then we try to see which music had the highest influence on their brain.
How interesting, huh?
They go and listen to that as a way of regulating their brainwaves.
I love that. Well, I've really enjoyed this. I just am so pleased to have met you, and I look forward to talking with you again. And I want you to tell people how to find you, both online and in person.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on your show, and I appreciate it. Also, it was great meeting you and having a chat with you yesterday. Also, have a conversation in person. So I practice in North Vancouver at North Shore Naturopathic Clinic. The best way really to reach me is either online or call our direct line. It's 604-986-7774. That's our clinic line. And we are in Lower Lonsdale and West Third in North Vancouver.
Well, your work is very, very exciting, and I thank you so much for being, I call it a paradigm shifter. That's what you're doing, shifting our paradigm of thought, aren't you?
Yeah, it is. It has shifted my paradigm of practice, having neurofeedback as part of my practice, yeah.
And you referred to something as an ocean. I thought, it's just beginning, isn't it?
This is just the beginning, yeah.
Thank you again. And this is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for tuning in to Paradigm Shifters. And thanks to Saeed Mushtaq, doctor, naturopathic physician, for joining us today and helping us change our brains. Many blessings.